Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to the Tolkien Road, episode 332. In this episode, we'll be continuing our journey through the fall of Numenor as we explore the section titled The Life of Numenoreans. In this section, we'll learn about the mundane realities of life in the Land of Gift. Before I get started, I'd like to give a double up air five to our amazing fellowship. Get those hands up, everybody. 3, 2, 1. Whoopsht. Very nice. Very nice. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, John R., Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Jacob Lockham, John H., and Eru27. Also, a shout out to those celebrating their fellowship anniversary in April of 2023, Jonathan D., Julia, and Katie P. Thank you all so much for sticking with us over the last year. Join the Fellowship of the Road by visiting patreon.com/Tolkien Road. When you join the Fellowship of the Road, it helps us to keep on evering on and land you some cool perks along the way. Learn more at patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Hey, YouTube, hit that like button. Don't forget to subscribe and let us know what's on your mind in the comments below. Before I get into the episode, I want to give another shout-out. I did this on the last episode. Another shout-out to a couple of recent interviews I've done on other podcasts. The first is to The Mythic Mind with Andrew Snyder. You can check that out by going over to tolkienroad.com/mythicmind. Andrew's doing some interesting work diving into the Tales from the Perilous Realm as of late, so you definitely want to check that out. We talked about On Fairy Stories as well as some of the other Tales from the Perilous Realm, miscellaneous writings from Tolkien. Also, Window on the West from theonering.com. TolkienRoad.com/window will take you to that interview. They're having a lot of fun going through the Silmarillion and doing some interviews with other folks, other Tolkien peeps, if you will, right now. So you'll definitely want to check out at least my interview and probably a whole lot more. All right. So what was it like to be an everyday Numenorean? How did it feel to be one of the blessed number who were able to enjoy a much longer lifespan in an island paradise? While these details may not seem of particular importance in advancing the story of Numenor's downfall, they do help us to better grasp the significance of being Numenorean and to juxtapose life in the Land of Gift with our everyday lives. Perhaps through these details, we can arrive at a better characterization of Numenorean culture so that we can more deeply understand the root causes of her downfall. So this section is pretty long, and the sources it pulls from are Unfinished Tales, really a description of Numenor, that section from the Second Age portion of Unfinished Tales, and then The Nature of Middle-earth. And then there's excerpts from Letters, the Letters of J.R.R. Tolkien, as well as A Calibeth, and I think that about covers everything. There may be one or two tiny other references in there, but that about covers everything. But there's a lot in this chapter, so, you know, and it's just kind of organized to give glimpses, like kind of encyclopedic, give glimpses of what life was like, you know, in different aspects for Numenoreans. It starts off with telling us some about the cities of Numenor, and really, this section is pretty short. It just tells us about a couple of cities, right? The first being Andúnié. Andúnié was the chief city and haven facing west. So this was facing towards the Blessed Realm. It was on the west coast of Numenor. It also mentions Armenelos, the capital, which was on a hill near Minnultarma. It's actually like on the southeastern portion of Numenor, in the just at the foot of the Minnultarma right there. There's two other cities, though, that this section does not mention but are mentioned later in the chapter, so I'll go ahead and bring those up now. The first one is Romena, which is the chief port in the east, and then Ondosto, which is a city in the Northland. So there's four cities of Numenor that we really know about: Andúnié, Armenelos, Romena, and Ondosto. Andúnié, the port in the west; Romena, the port in the east; Armenelos, the capital, right in the center, really in the center of, almost in the center of the island of Numenor, and then Ondosto. The other just interesting little nugget from this particular portion is about Aelros, and it says that he was appointed by the Valar to be king. And I just thought it was important to highlight this because, you know, when we think of kings, typically in this day and age, we think of like kind of historical processes that brought people to be kings. You know, we don't have this view of like, you know, kings, you know, even the kings that do remain in the world, of being somehow like divinely appointed or something like that, right? That's just not something we attribute. Most people, I would say, attribute, at least in the cultures that I'm familiar with and a part of. Certainly in America, we have no kings. And even with our president, you know, it's like he's just an elected official, right? And he has a certain time period that he's going to be ruling for. But with Aelros, he was appointed by the Valar to be king, and the Valar are, of course, the appointed powers of Arda, right? The great powers of Arda: Manwë, Ulmo, Yavanna, Varda, Aule, right? These and many others. These were the powers appointed by Ilúvatar himself, the god of gods, right? The first and all powerful one. So you know, Aelros, there really was this sense of, you know, this divine right of kings, right? That he was appointed by the Valar to be king. Now, whether that was, bounded in any way, right? It was, you know, to say like, well, if you don't behave yourself, then you're not going to be king. We don't really get any picture of that. Until much later in the history, maybe, we could argue. But there's no, like, sense of any constitutional, you know, limits upon Aelros. It was just like, rule justly. All right, so continuing on, you know, with this idea of divine appointment, right? First of all, going to the Valar, and then upwards to Eru, we have this section that deals with the belief and worship of Numenor. First of all, it speaks about the Minotaurma, right? The Minotaurma, which is the pillar of heaven. It was sacred to the worship of Ilúvatar. This is the big mountain. So if you're looking at this chapter in your book, right? If you're looking at this chapter in your beautiful copy of The Fall of Numenor, then there's a pencil sketch right here, and it shows a city with a mountain in the background. Now, most likely, this is a view of Armenelos with the Minotaurma in the background. In fact, I think, is it actually named that? I believe it's called Armenelos. So that's the Minotaurma in the background that you see in that picture. The Minotaurma was the center point, and we talked about this in the geography section a few episodes ago. It's the center point of the island of Numenor. And it was upon the Minotaurma, and you can kind of see it in this picture too, it's like flat at the top, right? It was upon the Minotaurma that the Numenorians would go and kind of do a little pilgrimage up to the top three times a year for this corporate worship of Ilúvatar, right? The three prayers is what it's referred to as. So it was sacred to the worship of Ilúvatar. There were no buildings on its summit, right? It was only a flat place to gather the people of Numenor for that three times a year worship, but it was guarded by three eagles of Manwë. By the way, in The Nature of Middle-earth, there's this really interesting little passage detail where it says that the great eagles were in fact Maiar, okay? So when you talk about these eagles, now it's not saying necessarily like just normal eagles were Maiar, but, you know, when we think of the eagles that like play a big part in The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, as well as the eagles of Manwë, you know, they're probably Maiar, right? They're probably these lesser gods, these servants of Manwë, and I would say it's almost definite in the case of the three eagles that guard the Minotaurma. They're almost like looking over its sacredness for this, on behalf of Manwë there. And there's a couple of interesting footnotes in this particular portion as well. I want to read footnote 3, which is actually, or at least a portion of it. And this is from the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien, but I'll give a little bit of the background that's in this footnote as well. For Tolkien, the spiritual significance of the religious faith and observances of the Numenorians was not only ideologically central to the Lord of the Rings, and more broadly to his entire legendarium, but also had an applicability to the writer's own world. In a note intended as a personal comment on W.H. Auden's review of The Return of the King in the New York Times Book Review of 22 January 1956, Tolkien wrote, "In The Lord of the Rings, the conflict is not basically about freedom, though that is naturally involved. It is about God and his sole right to divine honor. The Eldar and the Numenoreans believed in the One, the true God, and held worship of any other person an abomination. Sauron desired to be a God-king and was held to be this by his servants. If he had been victorious, he would have demanded divine honor from all rational creatures and absolute temporal power over the whole world. So even if in desperation the West had bred or hired hordes of orcs and had cruelly ravaged the lands of other men as allies of Sauron, or merely to prevent them from aiding him, their cause would have remained indefeasibly right. As does the cause of those who oppose now the state god and marshal this or that as its high priest, even if it is true, as it unfortunately is, that many of their deeds are wrong, even if it were true, as it is not, that the inhabitants of the West, except for a minority of wealthy bosses, live in fear and squalor, while the worshippers of the state god live in peace and abundance and in mutual esteem and trust." Yeah, so there's a lot in there, but the kind of the basic thing to take away from that is that in Tolkien's view, the whole sweep of Middle-earth history is about God and his sole right to divine honor, right? That is the major theme. And so it's interesting when we hear that to see that the Menotarma, this system of worship, is central to Numenorean culture here, right? And this lasts all the way to the end, okay? And shortly thereafter, after we see this footnote, we see this notion that the Numenoreans thus began a great new good. I'll read this portion. "The Numenoreans thus began a great new good, and as monotheists, but with only one physical center of worship, the summit of the mountain Menotarma, pillar of heaven. Literally, for they did not conceive of the sky as a divided residence, as a divine residence, in the center of Numenor. But it had no building and no temple. All of such things had evil associations." So this was not about the Numenoreans constructing their own religion. This was the notion that they had been taught that they were to worship Iluvatar, right? That this is the actual worship that he wanted. It kind of harkens to that whole idea, right, from the Old Testament where, you know, David's like, "I want to build a house, I want to build a temple." And God basically tells David through Nathan the prophet, he says, you know, I don't want you to, right? It's your son that's going to build a temple. Right, it's your son that's going to build the true temple for me. I don't want you to. And we get something of that idea here, right? That Eru Iluvatar is not interested in this sort of like, this sort of worship where it's like, well, we're going to construct our system of worship. It's so simple with the Numenoreans. You go up to the top of the Menotarma and you pray three times a year. There's no like sacrifices or anything like that that are written about. It's just these three prayers at different times of the year. One would think simply to praise and give thanks to God, okay? So it's interesting how simple this is, and it's interesting that Tolkien calls this a great new good, right? This monotheistic system of worship being a great new good, and that it's one of the first things established, one of the first things we learned about the Numenorean culture, right? That they're this people, these men that are brought over here. And I think there's a lot that actually can be read into this and made of this, but I'm going to save all of that for another time because there's still a lot more to get to in this chapter. I've talked about it in a lot of other episodes and plan on, you know, I'm sure I'll continue to unpack that on the Tolkien Road as time goes on. All right. So, of language. So, there are really three languages to think about when it comes to Numenor. The first is the language of the West, the Adunaic, right? This is derived from the speech of the House of Hador, right? This is one of the three houses of men that are the, you know, really the people that become the Numenoreans, the houses of men that aided the elves of Beleriand in their struggle against Morgoth in the First Age. So Adunaic is like their language, right? It's almost like their sort of common tongue, if you will. But the truth is that many men had already adopted the language of the Beleriand elves. Sindarin, right? So Sindarin was the Elvish of Beleriand, okay? It was the Elvish language of Beleriand, and many men had started speaking that. So there's these two languages that are sort of the common speech of Numenor, Adunaic, which is the language that's native to men, and then Sindarin, which is the tongue they learned from the elves of Beleriand. And Sindarin, it seems, was really the daily tongue, right? So some spoke Adunaic, but over time it kind of became Sindarin was really the main tongue that people you know, people spoke in an everyday language. And then Quenya was the official and royal language of Numenor, all right? So Quenya is kind of this high elvish tongue. It's the tongue of the elves of the Blessed Realm. So this is what they named places, names, important records. They were all kept in Quenya. The names of the kings, the kind of the official names of the rulers of Numenor, we're going to find are all Quenyan up to a certain point. And then they change over to Adunaic, and that's all part of this narrative of the downfall of Numenor that we'll get to. Appearance and health. So what did the Numenorians look like? You know, what was their, you know, what were their physical characteristics in general? Well, I'm going to read this quote. The people, tall and strong, were agile and extremely aware. That is, they were in control of their bodily actions and of any tool or material they handled, and seldom made absent-minded or blundering movements, and they were very difficult to take off their guard. Accidents were thus unlikely to occur to them. If any did, they had a power of recovery and self-healing, which, if inferior to that of the Eldar, was much greater than that of the men of Middle-earth. Also among the matters of lore that they especially studied was Hroengolme, or the lore of the body and the arts of healing. Sicknesses or other bodily disorders were very rare in Numenor until the latter years. This was due both to the special grace of health and strength given to the race as a whole, but especially due to the blessing of the land itself, and also in some measure, no doubt, to its situation far out in the Great Sea. Animals were also mostly free from disease. All right. And then, you know, so some interesting things to glean from that. They were tall and strong, right? And we, you know, later we'll learn about, of course, Elendil, who you may already be familiar with. He was, you know, came much later in Numenor's history, but he was very, very tall, right? Especially, you know, by our standards, you know, NBA player tall, right? So they were tall, strong, agile, extremely aware. You know, these are the kind of the 1% physical specimens, it would seem, that would be like professional athletes to us today, right? You know, playing professional football, professional basketball, professional baseball, right? You know, these people, when you go out to see these sports and you're just like, wow, they're standing next to each other, you might not realize how big they are. But then if they get closer, if they're standing next to, you know, an average group of people, you're like, wow, those people, they're big, right? For the most of them, they're pretty big. So that's, you know, that's kind of what you envision when you're envisioning Numenorians. Elsewhere, the indication is that Numenorians were probably, like the average Numenorian was probably like 6'4", 6'5", right? So pretty tall, right? And they just had a lot of like bodily awareness too, right? The, you know, so these like top-notch athletic sort of qualities, right? Just command presence, but they also had, you know, they also had strong and sharp minds, right? They were very clear-witted, clear-minded, and they were able to, you know, to learn much. And in the next section on aging and longevity, it actually says that that's the reason they asked for the lifespan, right? They wanted to learn more, right? They wanted to be able to live longer in order to learn more, which is, I think, an interesting note. But Tolkien attributes, you know, the notion that their early death was uncommon, right? So not many, you know, they lived longer in the first place, and then not many even died early from any other causes like sickness or accidents or anything like that. And Tolkien attributes that to the grace of the Valar. So in terms of their aging and longevity, they asked for long life and peace, and they were granted it. They actually, and I thought this was really interesting, they asked for the lifespan of old, which would indicate that maybe going back a long ways, men were originally supposed to live much longer. You know, again, if you're familiar with the Old Testament, you see this idea. You go back to, like, you know, the first men in the Bible, and, you know, they're living like 800, 900 years, right? And then over time, you know, their lifespans get lower and lower until you get to Abraham, where it's like a couple hundred years. And, or maybe it's a little longer, but anyway, it's not the 800, 900 years. And then you get to, Moses, right? And it's, you know, maybe a little over 100 years at that point, right? So you see in the Old Testament, these lifespans waning like that. And it would seem that that's reflected in this text as well, okay? That maybe at some point in the past, and, you know, we talk about, when I eventually do get to talking about Athelbeth, Finrod, Ondreth, there are some really interesting allusions to this that seem to indicate that this was indeed part of the mythology that Tolkien had incorporated, some of these ideas of like this ancient history that of men that was mysterious and that was really unknown, really not recorded by them. It was just a distant memory, but they knew that they had it in the beginning. Their lives were much better, much more like the Numenoreans, maybe, until Melkor's influence came among them and started to ruin things for them. So it says also that they helped them to live longer by assimilating their life mode to that of the Eldar. And I think what's meant by that is this notion of how they aged. There is some really interesting stuff if you go into the nature of Middle Earth about the way they aged, like their aging tables. And it's actually, if you look at endnote eight in this particular section, go all the way to the back, it's going to show you kind of how to think about the lifespan of Numenoreans and what life was like for them at a particular age, right? So from 0 to 20, they developed physically at about the same rate as a normal man, right? So, you think about, I assume most of you watching this, are probably, at least 20. I'm sure there's some people that are younger than 20, but, you're getting there and, you develop at that rate. You're not really fully mature, even physically until 17, 18. Even then, you probably got some more growing to do, just some kind of more adult.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Adulting, if you will. I don't know if that's a good term to use, but just like you're, not looking so much like a kid anymore, even though you may be bigger and everything like that. But just 0 to 20 was kind of normal, right? It was normal for them. And then it says beyond that, add to this 20 the remainder divided by 5. Thus a Numenorean man or woman of years. So a Numenorean at the age, so for example, right? So the age of 31 for a normal person would be equivalent to the age of 75 for a Numenorean, all right? The age of 46 for a normal person would be equivalent to the age of 150 years old, okay? So you see this, if you kind of think about the prime years being from, roughly you're 20 years old, we'll just say 20 to 40, because people always say 40's over the hill. I'm over 40, so don't anybody take offense at that. I can attest to the over the hill thing. 20 to 40, maybe being the prime years, right? The years when you're really in like the best physical condition maybe you're ever going to be. Yeah, hopefully, maybe that's not the case, but let's just assume that for sake of argument. 20 to 40, that's really going to be like 25 to 125. So that 20-year span is more like 100 years span for a Numenorean. That's pretty awesome, right? Imagine having that, right? Imagine having that sort of lifespan, that sort of vigor, being in those prime years for much longer. And you can even make the argument, if you want to extend it all the way out to 60, okay? So just say when you're starting to maybe approach retirement age in your 60s, that's like 200 years, right? So 0 to 20 are all the same. And then beyond 20, you multiply by 5, right? For the Numenorean equivalent age, right? So it's all there in the end note for you to go over, and that's how to understand it. It talks also about like world weariness. So, for the Numenoreans, they would know that it was maybe time to depart this world because a sort of world weariness would set in. They would be like, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to move beyond this world. Okay. And I think this is going to become something that we revisit, this concept, which I won't get into it again too much right now, because it comes up a lot later on in the story of Numenor, because there's a change in the mindset of the people of Numenor from like, okay, I can accept that my death is going to be soon. I'm getting old. I'm getting weary of this world, and I'm ready to move on. Whereas as people become, they actually turn away from Iluvatar and the worship of Iluvatar, and they're seduced by Sauron into evil ways, and they start to become afraid of death, right? They start to be like, oh, I want to resist death, right? I don't want to die, right? You know, even like the natural death, okay? So that theme of world weariness is going to come up again, and how the Numenoreans viewed that phenomenon setting into them. Their mental capacity was greater and developed quicker. So, you know, even though maybe physically they developed at the same rate up to 20, like a 7-year-old Numenorean would have been much more mentally advanced than a 7-year-old normal person. And they spent a lot of their time engrossed in lore, crafts, and intellectual or artistic pursuits in the first half of life. All right, marriage and child raising. Marriage was regarded as natural for all, and once entered into was permanent. So divorce wasn't really a thing amongst the Numenoreans. Women married typically from the ages of 20 to 45, and 45 being 25 equivalent. So think of it in terms of our 20 to 25 was the normal, like the prime sort of marrying age for women. They didn't marry any younger than that, really, right? That was actually looked down, like very almost like explicitly forbidden for the Numenoreans for a woman to marry before that age. And they could marry, women could marry up to 95, which is the equivalent age 35 in this case, right? So 20 to 45 was the normal range. So there's actually a 25-year span in there that was the normal range for Numenorean women to marry, and then up to 95 is sort of possible, which, you know, for most of us being like, wow, 95-year-old woman getting married, you don't hear about that every day. But in this case, we're talking about a 35-year-old woman equivalent, right? Remember that 150 years being sort of like, okay, now you're kind of over the hill, right? That's when you're reaching that over the hill point. Men married from the age of 45 to 120, and that's the normal man equivalent, 25 to 40, all right? They were monogamous, so there was no polygamy, there was no divorce, and really, 4 children was kind of the max for Numenoreans. Up to 4 children in a period of 50 to 75 years, so they spaced their children quite a bit. 50 to 75 year range would be about a 12 to 18 year range in normal human terms. So if you think about that, that's like 3 to 4 years per child. So that, you know, that's a good bit of spacing right there. Just that in 3 to 4 years in normal human terms, you're talking about 4 children. Like, so if, you know, let's just say 60 years, right? That's every 15 years is a child, and that's 4 children is the max, right? Like the most Numenoreans would have. So if you just were a 2 or 3 children family, it could be like 20-year, you know, span. So in the begetting and still more in the bearing of a child, far more of their vigor, both of mind and body, was expended, right? So this was like the elves, right? So the elves also didn't have a lot of children typically because Feanor maybe being the exception, but in the begetting and the bearing of children, they gave a lot of themselves, right? They gave a lot of themselves. And, you know, this is something we don't always think of in our own terms, but I think it's a great insight from Tolkien that he incorporates this whole idea into his mythology, because he incorporates it not only when it comes to the begetting and bearing of children, but also when it comes to the creation of art, right? That we expend something of ourselves when we create our art, right? Which is something we've talked about a good bit on this podcast in the past. And he says they were steadfast lovers, not lustful, right? So they were not lustful, but, you know, once they chose their mate, right, they were steadfast. They were steadfast in that marriage. They were steadfast to that love. So, so a lot to commend about the Numenoreans in all of these descriptions. Of appetites and behaviors, they had a conscious detestation of lust, greed, hate, and cruelty, and tyranny. These were very much against them, and though they were mostly virtuous folk, there were some wicked among them. So some bad folks did kind of creep in initially, and maybe more over time. Not all of them, you know, were perfect angels necessarily, but for the most part, they were a good and virtuous people, and, you know, they had certain values that we would probably, you know, very much agree with, and the, you know, detesting lust, greed, hate, cruelty, tyranny. All these things. All right. Of skills and crafts. So this was a word I was not familiar. Well, I think I probably heard it before, but I didn't know what it meant initially. It says metals aroused in them cupidity. So cupidity is greed for money or possessions. So maybe it's a little bit of what's going on with Gollum in terms of my precious and wanting to possess, you know, the one ring and an extreme amount of cupidity on his part. They didn't have a lot of metals. They didn't bring a lot of metals with them. There weren't a lot of metals for them in Numenor, and it was metals that ended up being kind of contributing to their initial decline when they came back to Middle-earth, because they found these things and they found them precious, and it aroused in them greed. Okay, it aroused in them greed. As far as weapons go, Numenor was a land of peace initially. I'll read this passage. Thus, for long, there were practically no weapons of warlike intent made in Numenor. Many things made could of course be so used: axes and spears and bows. The Boyars were a great craft. They made bows of many kinds: long bows, smaller bows, especially those used for shooting from horseback, and they also devised crossbows, at first used mainly against predatory birds. Shooting with bows was one of the greatest sports and pastimes of men, and one in which young women also took part. They didn't have a lot of weapons at first. It was only over time and as war sort of came to them that weapons became more of a necessity. But they did have a lot of bow makers, and the, you know, archery, I guess you could say, was one of their great pastimes, right? Men and women alike. Speaking of sports and pastimes, there's a lot to say in this area. So there was no war, though they were descended from men of war, so their energies needed to be directed to peaceful occupations, such as the making of crafts, as well as games and physical sports. So, you know, they came from these great warriors, right? The people of Numenor were descended from these great warriors, and we already described that they were physically impressive specimens, right? They were physically impressive specimens. So all of that energy needed to be directed somewhere. And if they weren't warlike people, if Numenor was not a land of war, all of those energies needed to be expended in some way. So the things, they were very fond of hiking, of climbing cliffs. They took their greatest delight in the sea, right? So especially men. They taught themselves shipbuilding. Initially, they had very limited knowledge, but over time, they taught themselves shipbuilding to be able to go back eventually to Middle-earth, although they did a lot of transit just around the island, too. Women were known for their love of dancing and horses and their disdain for the sea. So women loved horses and dancing, and they hated the sea. We'll see this when we come to the story of Aldarion and Orendis, the mariner's wife. There was a main road from Romena to Armenalos. So remember, Romena being the easternmost port, and then to Armenalos, right? There was a main road, and eventually they extended that to Undosto in the Northlands and Undunie in the Westlands. Okay, so there was this road that traversed the island from east to west. They were not so much in, though they loved their horses, they were not so much into horse racing, but it was kind of a thing to be able to train your horse so that to know their master's voice. So they were, you know, loved the handling of horses, right? But they were not into the sport of horse racing, I guess you could say. And I don't know, maybe horse racing itself is kind of viewed, maybe traditionally it was viewed negatively. I can understand that, you know, cause of course it's associated with gambling a lot of days in a lot of cases today. But there are other things to do, with horses as far as sport goes. So, maybe go check out Yellowstone if you want to see some of those things, the rodeo and all that. I don't know if that's what they were doing. But the horses knew their master's voices, and that was kind of the thing, is developing the relationship between the men and their horse, right? Numenorians also loved their dogs. Women loved that the Numenorian men loved the dogs, and then women loved birds, beasts, and squirrels. We talked about the love of squirrels in the previous chapter. Women really loved the squirrels of Numenor, and there were a lot of them in Numenor. And it says their knowledge and arts reached an almost elvish height. Okay, and they did have what's the right word? They kept company with the elves of Eresea, right? The elves of the Lonely Island, just one stop away from the Blessed Realm. And this was, I suppose, where they gained a lot of their, you know, their knowledge and arts initially, is from these elves of Eresea. The elves of Eresea brought to Numenor many gifts, and the most important, perhaps, was the tree Nimloth, the seedling of Celeborn, which was a seedling of Galathelion, the image of Telperion. So this is the whole White Tree of Numenor idea, and I've actually made a video devoted just to the White Tree of Numenor, an episode devoted just to that from a while back, if you want to go check that out to understand how that all works. And of course, the White Tree of Numenor leads into the White Tree of Gondor. But Nimloth was the name of this white tree, and it existed for most of the history of Numenor, and it plays a very important role. It's kind of a symbol of Numenor's status and its friendship with the elves and the Blessed Realm. For those of you who don't know what Telperion is and kind of this descent of Nimloth from Telperion, well, it's not directly descended, but Telperion was one of the two trees of Valinor, which were these, great trees, that are before the First Age, and they're a huge part of the story of the Silmarillion. Well, there was an image of Telperion, not a natural descendant, but an image of it that was made by Yavanna called Galathelion. And this was given to the elves of the Blessed Realm. And then Celeborn was a seedling of Galathelion, and Nimloth is a seedling of Celeborn. Now, don't get Celeborn the tree confused with Celeborn, the husband of Galadriel. All right, so obviously two completely different things, although it's interesting that they share a name. So that's the story. That's where the White Tree of Numenor came from, and of course we'll come back to the White Tree of Numenor in later parts of this series. All right, and then we have this idea of the Bliss of Numenor being the first 2,000 years of its history. So, you know, we've kind of learned over these last several episodes about what Numenor was like early on, when it was really this blessed place, right? This land of bliss. And we understand that this bliss lasted for roughly 2,000 years. And I love the last line here, or maybe it's the last line. Let's see, make sure that's the last line. I just posted this to my Twitter feed. Oh, yes. Victory was the herald of their downfall. The context here is simply that they had all of this peace for about 2,000 years. But it says, though the first hints of the later shadows appeared before that, indeed it was their very arming to take part in the defense of the Eldar and men of the west of Middle-earth against the wielder of the shadow, at length revealed as Sauron the Great, that brought about the end of their peace and content. Victory was the herald of their downfall, right? So they are forced to become a people warlike, and that comes back to them, right? It's so interesting to think about that, too, in the context of, like, our own history, right? Thinking about how World War II being this pivotal event that, you know, Tolkien lived through, and he was conceiving a lot of the Legendarium during that time. You know, and you can even think of World War I and World War II as kind of being, like, part of the same continuous conflict in a way. You think of that great conflict of world wars during the first and middle part of the 20th century. And, you know, all of the things, all of the tyrannies and those sort of things that were overcome during that period, all of the great bloodshed, the victories for, you know, freedom and those sorts of ideas, democracy, those sorts of ideals. And then you see so much, you think of the victory, well, it's victory, but then it leads to all of these other problems, right? And you know, I won't get into the politics of what all of that looks like, but, you know, there's no doubt that, like, in some ways, the relative peace of the post-World War II era seems to be coming apart in a lot of ways, right? Now, you may say, well, that all depends on your viewpoint. Fair enough. But I think for Tolkien, he probably would have had that viewpoint, right? That in the victory that he would have applauded in World War II, we see seeds sown that are going to lead to bigger problems further down the road, even for the victors. So, maybe that's the poetic aspect, the poetic flourish that we can end this particular section with, of mundane realities, but with all things Tolkien, they really have deeper truths that are reflected in them. So that's the beauty of this section. We already talked about the illustration of Armenelos, the pencil sketch at the beginning. There's one other illustration in here that's titled Looking West from Andunier. Andunier, again, being that city on the western coast of Numenor where the elves of Eressëa usually came to visit. And in this color painting by Alan Lee, we see something of what this might have looked like, a vision of what this might have looked like, this bright light looking into the west towards the Blessed Realm. All right. So, yeah, that's it for this particular section. You know, a lot of really interesting details in here. I don't know if there's anything that I didn't cover that you guys would be interested in talking more about. Please feel free to do so in the comments below. Or hit me up, just send me a note to TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com or hit me up on Twitter. But yeah, you know, again, these topics might not seem like the most important, but they help us to characterize and understand what Numenor was like on an everyday basis so that the stories that are going to follow from here really make a lot more sense and hit a little deeper, right? All right. Well, hey, if you like this episode and if you like the Tolkien Road, please subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes or the platform of your choice. If you are a 5-star fan of the Tolkien Road, you can really help us out by heading over to iTunes or your preferred source for the show and dropping us a rating and review. When you do that, it helps get the word out about the Tolkien Road, which helps us to keep on evering on. All right. Well, we did a pretty long one this week, so I'm not going to hit any correspondence, but on the next couple of episodes dealing with the fall of Numenor, I probably will hit some correspondence because they're shorter sections. So look forward to those. Keep the correspondence coming. Thank you to our amazing patrons, especially the following: John R., Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Jacob Lockham, John H., Eru27, Emilio P., Jonathan D., Mike M., Robert H., Paul D., Julia, Wordy, Joe Bagelman, Richard K., Matt R., Matthew W., Garrett P., Chris K., John W., Eugene D., Chris B., Daniel S., Seb M., Shana Supreme, Corey C., Ms. Anonymous, Andrew T., Red Hawk, Shannon S., Brian O., Zeke F., James L., Chris L., Azia V., Ish of the Hammer, Teresa C., David of Pints with Jack, and Eric B. All right. Thank you all. Thank you to our amazing patrons. We really appreciate you. And thanks to everybody for watching and or listening. We will talk at you next time. Bye-bye.